folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima McGinn, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Native Shark, which is an online platform for learning Japanese. And what Native Shark do is they make learning Japanese really, really simple. You log in, you click a button that says study now, and the platform then shows you exactly what you need to learn next based on your previous progress. Now, again, this is simple, but the way it's designed means that students who use Native Shark once a day for 4 to 5 months can complete the equivalent of over 2 years of university study. And this is not just them patting themselves on the back. Now that Native Shark's been in business for over a year, the results are in. So this is exactly what people are saying. Just looking at a couple of posts in their community forums, and the student community, by the way, is one of the best things about the platform. So one person's writing, most productive year I've had learning Japanese. And then another one says, I've started learning over a year ago with all of these other platforms, and what I learned there is only a fraction of what I've learned on Native Shark in just 3 months. And then yet another one goes, in my mind, my study timeline only started with Native Shark because that's when I really started learning consistently, and on and on. So yet the proof's in the pudding. It's definitely the best online course out there. And since you've heard about it here on the podcast, you also get an extra little bonus. If you sign up for their free trial using the URL nativeshark.com/NTI, and we'll link to it in this episode's show notes. So that's native without an E. So N-A-T-I-V shark, all one word, .com/NTI. You use that link to sign up and you'll get a double length free trial. So 2 weeks free instead of just the one. No need to put in your credit card, anything of that sort. You can just sign up, give it a shot. And chances are at the end of these 2 weeks, you'll already be far ahead of wherever you are with your Japanese at the moment, whether you're just starting out or you're already in knee deep. Give it a shot. nativeshark.com/NTI. Now, before we dive into today's episode, as usual, a quick reminder on our December business networking and board/cards/strategy games weekend in Fukuoka. We're really looking forward to meeting as many of you as possible. Unfortunately, the borders are still closed to non-residents, but if you're in Japan and you've got even a passing interest in business and you want to have an awesome weekend, so honing your strategic planning, resource management, social interaction, risk assessment skills through games, as well as, of course, form personal and business connections, listen to awesome speakers, have some brainstorming sessions with like-minded individuals, and eat fabulous food prepared especially for you. This one is the event of the year, and we're hoping to make it an annual thing from here on. So 10 to 12 December, Friday through to Sunday at the Hotel Montan in Hakata, Fukuoka. Amazing venue. Check it out in the show notes. We've got the event page there for you and also the booking link. You do need to book in advance, and we're not sure exactly when, but registration will close at some point. And also, again, while flights from Tokyo, Osaka, etc. are cheap budget flights, the prices are slowly rising and will likely continue to rise as we get closer to the day. So if you haven't booked your tickets now, now is the time. Again, link in the show notes, or just hop over to our website, nippontradings.com. Scroll down a bit and you'll see it there somewhere towards the middle of our homepage. Okay, so for today's episode, yet another JREP Japan Real Estate Experts panel session with the four usual suspects, and carrying on from our renovation and rebuild session a few weeks back. So we were talking about when is it better to renovate versus rebuild a property. So this time we dive deeper into renovations, both structural and interior maintenance, as well as pre-sale renovations and staging, etc., and how this all differs between rental investment properties and owner-occupied properties. What happens when you upgrade your home and you need to flip over your mortgage to a new property, builder warranties, official property evaluations, and property tax statements. But before all that, we've got some fun stuff. So Matt's introduced us to the world of goat blogs, or as he likes to call them, goat Tinder. He talks a bit about garbage castles or structures that are built of recycled materials. Emil gets a bit panicky about an earthquake, or at least a little tremor that he felt there. So yeah, pretty exciting and funny episode. Enjoy, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Well, it's, yeah. So in the link that I sent in the chat is there's actually a few of these services out there. They all are like 1997 BBSs. It's ridiculously dated. But if you click through to Happy Goat, this is one way that you can find goats for free.
I need to share this screen, hang on.
Happy goat, happy me.
That's
Oh, that's a
important.
cute one.
More.
Oh wow, there's a new one, a cute little goat that was only born on the 7th of this month.
Share your goats.
You gotta scroll down a little bit.
Is that like a Pokemon thing?
Kind
You
of.
can
So
share the
these are the listings. These are right, you're looking at goat listings.
Oh, that's so cute.
And
I
so
wonder if
you
you're allowed to keep them in a mansion apartment. Probably not, right? I
one
wouldn't do it
thing.
to the goat too, but I'm just wondering.
Goats aren't as bad. The chickens, you don't think about, or at least I never did, like chickens don't shut up for the most part. And
Yep.
so if you have, don't be that person that has, I don't know, a bunch of chickens near your, unless you're on top of the building or something, because they're very loud. It's a real cute one.
They are very cute.
So yeah, we might be going to get another goat sometime soon and also check out some more Akia.
So you're a goat collector now, are you?
Yeah, kind of. Yes. I mean, what do we do with, we don't really, we just feed them stuff.
To trade them.
Aren't they good for cutting the grass and stuff?
Yeah, so that's why we got them originally, is because we don't even own it. It's just the local government had what amounts to just like Akia land or farmland that wasn't being used. And a friend of mine just kind of asked, like, well, I don't want to sell anything, so like I don't, you know, need licensing or anything, but can we just like build tree houses and you know, plant potatoes and stuff and just like try our hands at being farmers because none of us know what we're doing. And they're like, oh yeah, go have a great time. But it was totally overgrown. And honestly, most of it still is. And so we got the goats to eat a bunch of the, well, unfortunately, they also eat the stuff we planted now. So that's a problem we have to figure out. But yes, they are very good lawnmowers.
And they're good with fences too, right? Like fences don't really stop them, do they?
Well, no, that's the most recent thing that we did. We've got, so this, I refer to our hobby farm as like the garbage castle because it's just built entirely out of garbage. And so we have like, it used to be, I guess it still technically is a, what do you call it? Like a hot house, greenhouse. There we go. But all of the vinyl and kind of everything that makes it enclosed and stuff is rotted away and whatnot. But there's still like, you know, a bunch of metal girders and just, you know, wooden boxes and stuff. So if you just rip them apart, you can make a lot of fences. I learned how to make stairs and level planes and stuff. So yeah, we've got what, five houses now that we've built out of, not like shacks, not houses, that we've built out of all of this garbage when, you know, they're just like, that's where we keep our shovels and, you know, whatnot. And so we also have the goat fence that we built out of a bunch of rusty rusty metal bolts. So yeah, anyway, you can do a lot with vacant land.
And fences and goats.
Yes.
Okay, so let me ask you a
Kick it
question.
off.
I'm not sure if you could all chime in on that, but this is something that actually I've been getting a feel for over the years that I've been working, but I've never actually got an official answer. So maybe you guys would know better than me. And the question is, how is property tax or official evaluations that come with the property tax, how is that assessed and how often? So I know that we get a property tax statement every year and it's always slightly different, but it's always vastly different to market price. So how do these actually work? How does the government or the tax department evaluate the official value of a property and why is it never similar to market value? Do you have any ideas?
Hold on, there's a little earthquake. I'm getting a little tremor. right now. So,
really? Oh.
Yes, yeah. No. I'm on the third floor. So.
I hope we don't end up on the found footage film the moment the earthquake.
That'd be good content.
So there was a small earthquake in Victoria, in Melbourne this morning.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, where I'm from. So I was getting messages from like, you know, in the chats and stuff like that from my people in Australia, my family and whatnot. And they're like, oh, it was a six, magnitude six. And my wife's in the chat as well. And she's like, oh, you got a magnitude six. I go, oh, yeah, but that's an Aussie six. It's not the Japanese six. The Shindo six is whatever. I like brushed it aside. And like people in Australia, like, we have to leave the house, but wait, we're in lockdown.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
We allowed to leave the house to evacuate for an earthquake. I think it's pretty minor, though. But I think for Australia,
I think earthquake beats mandatory corona lockdown any day of the week. Yeah.
Is that like a John Ken Pong kind of thing?
Yeah. You stay inside the crumbling brick house. Where were we? Tax, land tax,
property tax, official evaluation.
Yeah. Okay. So I cannot give an answer on how they come up with their figure, but the the assessment valuation for land tax assessment is significantly lower than market price. And then you pay a percentage of that. And I forget the actual numbers. It's like there's a local tax and then a special tax.
Yeah, and it's also lower for properties under 200 square meters and higher properties over to us. So there's a bit of a formula to it. But why is it so different to market price? Do you have any idea?
Well, they it's very specifically for, it's a valuation for land tax assessment, not a market price valuation. And why it's different, I don't know. But yeah, we don't see them being near like market value. Even if you say, I bought this yesterday at this price, they'll come and do the tax evaluation for the official valuation for land tax assessment is a much lower price. It ends up being around the tax you have to pay yearly in Tokyo and like in the suburbs we're at is usually about 0.25% to 0.5% of what the market price would be.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, anywhere from, you know, 100 to 300,000 yen a year. And then in terms of when it's assessed, and I'll let you know sort of the importance of it for when you're doing a purchase. So when you purchase your own family home, it is assessed, I believe, every May. In May, that's when you receive the letter for your land tax bill. But it is billed to the person who owned it on January 1st. Okay, so land tax assessment is for the tax liability is whoever owns the property on January 1st. So, and when you purchase a house, you have to pay a daily pro rata for whatever the land tax is. Because the owner owned it on January 1st, then
they would get the bill, yeah.
Yeah, they get the bill. So when you do the settlement, will say, okay, this is the property price. You owe, just say, 80 million. You bought the property for 80 million yen. You paid a 2 million yen deposit. So you have a 78 million yen on settlement day. You know, you have to pay the seller 78 million yen plus the remaining land tax prorated for the day. So if you buy the property on December 1st, if settlement is December 1st, you owe the landlord 31 days of, sorry, you owe their seller 31 days of land tax. So they say, okay, the land tax was, 200,000 yen divided by 365 times 31. And that's what you have to pay on top of your 78 million yen. Okay? Yeah. So if you buy the property on in like middle of the year, you have to pay roughly 50% of the land tax. If you buy it towards the end of the year, your land tax that you need to pay for that year is, of course, are going to be a lot less. Let's say you buy it on December 1st, you need to pay 31 days of land tax with your transaction, which you pay to the seller of the property. You don't pay to the ward office.
Yeah.
Okay. And then for because you're the owner on January 1st, the following year, on around May, you'll receive the bill for the full of, you know, in this case, January 2022. Okay. And you can either pay it off at once, or I believe there's four installments you can do.
Yeah, but the I'll just slight amendment there. We have actually
three installments.
Is it three or four? It's four. Sorry, four installments.
Four installments. Yeah. If you want to, you can pay it all in one go, but you can make it four installments quarterly. Yeah.
Yeah, I just pay it off in one installment because.
And there's never any benefit. Oh really? But there's never any like. There's never an incentive. Like, it's not as if you get a discount for paying it all off, like, in advance. I'd be more inclined to do that.
Well, it's just load off your brain. I just don't want to have to think about it the rest of the year. I'd just rather get rid of it.
Yeah. Just a one-time payment, and that's it. I get so many bills. You know, we have multiple properties. And the same with, like, the car. Like, you got car tax. You get so many different bills. And if you start dividing it up, instead of being four one-time payments, you have, you know, 16 payments. you have to split up at different times.
Right. And
it starts to spread out. So I'm like,
reminders to yourself to get them paid and stuff like that. We have actually, I was going to say, we have actually had a case where the official valuation, a few cases where the official valuation was higher than the market price. And that was, I think, because they're probably a bit outdated with market movements. So in Sapporo, for example, when we just started working, which was 2011-12, Sapporo took a big hit after the big Tohoku earthquake in 2011, and when tourists stopped coming to Hokkaido for skiing, so the economy there took a hit and market prices took a hit, but the government was still taxing official evaluations that were way higher than market price. So at that point, we were actually paying annual property tax that was like 2-2.5% a year, like a lot higher than what it usually is. But any other time, you're right, it's always a lot less than the official market price. Yeah.
One more thing I wanted to just add on to how the payment works. So I explained that.
It's usually because everything is a year out, right?
A year retro. A year ahead or a year retro? I always forget. Hello?
Tracy, your connection is very poor. We can see you move your hands, but not
like actually. Taxes and everything are always a year off, right?
She said her internet was.
I better log out, log back in again.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll log out, log in again.
But I think your question was, taxes are evaluated a year out. They're evaluated this year for, and then you're liable the following year. I think for land tax, is it every two or every, it's not every year that they do their evaluation. I'm not sure
how it is. Okay.
It's not a yearly valuation. Like, so the valuation you get is valid, I think, for 2 or 3 years, and then they'll redo the valuation.
Well, that explains why it's always a bit off, because they're not, it takes them a while to catch up with market trends.
Yeah, but market trends don't move that much anyway.
Well, depending on the year, depending, like just before the Olympics, we were seeing a lot of price hikes, and then Fukuoka, when Fukuoka was, you know, first becoming familiar to people, it suddenly jumped almost double market price in about 4 or 5 years. So it does happen, not as much as it does in other countries. But Matt, how about your are your tax property tax are your official evaluations always close to zero, or do you also get higher ones?
Well, it's kind of a fuzzy sort of fuzzy math kind of thing, just because especially with the older properties, they tend to kind of lie there. So coming in at under market it's kind of difficult to tell from the get-go exactly what they're coming in as if they're not being administered properly. Generally speaking, though, once you kind of get, and of course this is sort of part of the service, once you get the whole story put together, I don't think that there's anything very kind of different coming out of the kind of the rural market or Akiya as well. That doesn't seem to be very much different from what you're talking about or what you're
so you don't see official evals that are like zero, close to zero, anything like that? The prices kind of end up just prices and evaluations that go with it kind of end up staying there and sort of get accepted as kind of common knowledge until there's reason to actually update them, yeah. As it were. So, but then again, it's also case by case. But if you get further out into the sticks, things can get pretty dirty so far as having those on record is concerned.
Hmm.
Okay. I just wanted to add, I don't know if you need to let Tracy back in the room or not, because you're the host, so I'm not certain. Well, but,
I didn't get a message saying that she is.
Okay.
I'm not getting any request. Yeah.
Okay. No worries. Yeah, she's probably just restarting her system. I just wanted to add, you know, I did say that the annual land tax is sort of you pay pro rata when you settle, when you do a house purchase, you pay the annual pro rata, whatever the daily rate is that's remaining. When you buy a mansion, the same thing happens for management fees
And rental income if it's tenanted.
And the repair fund, yeah. It gets...
No, and rental income, I mean, if you got a tenant in there, you also need to credit or debit for the rental income, because the seller would have collected rental income for the next month or two, so they need to credit you for that as well.
Yeah, so that there's the rental income, it's a rental property, but the management fee, so if you get it on the 15th of the month, you'll generally need to pay the 15 days for that month because the seller has already paid it.
Yeah.
And also the next month, because generally the seller pays 1 month in advance. So the seller would have prepaid, you know, so now we're in September 22nd. So if you buy it today, you need to pay the other 9 days for the end of this month, plus all of next month. You'll pay that to the seller. And from for November, like 2 months ahead, that's when you'll start paying for it directly to the management company.
Yep. Tracy's back with us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it says Tracy is the host now. Yep, there she is. Her screen.
Welcome back, Tracy. Almost
there.
Well, she jumps on. Sorry, Ziv, do you have any other questions? I've got one that I had this week that I'll...
One more, but that one might take some time to address. So maybe you go with yours first. I'll keep mine for later.
Oh, welcome back, Tracy. Good to see you. So I had a client meeting today, and he's interested in the process of... He currently has a house. He bought, I think it was like in the past 2 or 3 years, so not too long ago. But he's... thinking of, like, you know, his job employment circumstances have changed. He has more income and more budget to buy a larger, more attractive property. And he's thinking either do that purchase, so just upgrade his property, sell his existing one and buy another one, or or keep the existing one as an investment and buy another property, okay, for him to live, the bigger, grander one.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of, let me say, a bit of a common scenario, or the idea of wanting to just upgrade, get a bigger place is pretty common if you've outgrown your existing one, regardless of how long you've been there. So how that works with the bank, because bank financing is the big issue. In general, like, let's say you earn 10 million yen a year, you can borrow 70 mil. So the bank will loan you about 7 times your gross annual income. If you earn 10 million yen, the bank will loan you 70. Let's say you've purchased the first property for 60 million yen, okay? You have residual borrowing capacity of about 10 million if you wanted to buy an investment property or buy a or upgrade your family home. If you want to buy another home for yourself, you probably cannot get anything decent for 10 million yen, especially if you're going from 60 million yen property and you want to upgrade to a something bigger and grander. So in that situation, you'll need to most likely sell your first property and then buy your second one, because the banks don't allow you to have two home loans at once for the most part. But the strategy with that, some people think, oh, I need to sell my property first, pay it off, and then I need to quickly find another one, right, within that settlement period, which logistically is difficult, and you don't want to end up stuck, you know, with only a few months, like 2 months to find your proper dream home. So what actually happens is the banks will allow you, after you purchase a second property, 6 months to sell the first property. Okay.
That's very nice.
Yeah. So it's, so you need to have like, when you, so, you know, let's say you want to buy your upgrade, you want to buy a second property. You go to the bank and you make the application and they'll ask you, do you have an existing property? And you say, yes, my current home. They say, what are you going to do with it? And of course, oh, I'm going to sell it. You know, you have no choice. So in that scenario, you, the bank said, okay, find your next property, make the application, and then we'll give you the, you can buy that. Once you've settled on the second property, you need to start actively selling your first property. And before they actually give you the loan, you'll usually need to get a contract with an agent. So for example, like ourselves, a contract to engage in the sale process. So we're going to officially act as your agent to start selling and advertising your own property. And they're going to want to see that contract.
That's enough to satisfy the bank that the process has started.
That you're engaged with an agent to try and actively sell your property. And yes, that's enough. But, you know, so for example, and generally our clients would be dealing with us. Okay. So they would, you know, we'd buy the first property, we'd buy the property, but we'd also provide the bank with the contract. You know, they've agreed that we're going to start trying to sell the first one. Then once they settle, they can actually start the selling process before they settle on the new one, on the new house. Okay. Because, you know, they want to probably sell it as quickly as possible. And whoever makes the offer on the first house, they say, great, you can settle, but the house, our new house is not going to be built until January. So you can, we can settle middle of January. All right.
Yeah, that's pretty common. We've actually even had a case where even after settlement, the seller got special permission to stay for another couple of months.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, there's different scenarios, but generally you have to actively be engaged in trying to sell it. And they want you to sell it within 6 months. We had one property that was in December 2019 is when he bought his second property. And then we started trying to sell his first property. And that's when COVID sort of in March of 2020 is when lockdown happened. So it took us about 8 months to sell. Not, we couldn't get it within the 6 month window. But after 6 months, the bank was calling our agency saying, what's going on? Have you sold it yet? Have you sold it? And when we finally did, we said, look, we have some other clients, but because we're in the middle of lockdown, state of emergency, there's very limited viewings that we can do. You know, and you know, early 2020, people were still very, very afraid, not nearly as, you know, fatigued as they were now. Yes, yeah, exactly. So, the bank was very much on our case quite a lot, pushing us. And then when we finally settled, we needed to provide them an updated land title to say that it's been transferred and that the owner no longer has the mortgage lien on the property. So that was quite a strict requirement from the bank. There's no penalty if you don't make the 6 month timeline, as long as you're actively trying to do it. The bank was not happy, but there was no financial penalty or anything like that. However, if the owner flagrantly just disregarded any attempt to sell it and rented it out and said, no, it's not even being advertised anymore, we're not trying, I'm going to keep it.
Yeah.
The bank said they would consider either changing the loan to a free loan, which means it's almost like an investment, like 2.5% investment loan, or asking to sell the new property. Okay. So, because they don't want him to keep two mortgages. So you cannot really go with it. If you tell the bank you're going to try and sell the property, if their condition to give you the new financing is that you have to sell the first property, they will not allow you just to ignore it and say, yeah, sorry, you know what? I'm just going to keep it. That's not okay. But in general, people are, you know, they're keen to sort of sell the first one so they can build a new one. So that's the process. You don't need to be renting for 2 months or 3 months until you find the current property. You can just buy one, and then you have 6 months to try and sell your first property.
Right.
That's the process.
Gotcha. Okay, well, I'll move on to question number two. And I think, actually, I'd love for you all to chime in because you'd have different perspectives on this one. So someone's asking, how much money should I be putting aside for maintenance of my home? So we've got our own experience with that, but I think you guys probably know, I mean, Tracy probably knows a whole lot about the interior wear and tear. And Emil, I'm sure, deals with on a regular basis, and Matt probably rebuilds them from the ground up every now and again. So I'd love to hear what you all think is like common maintenance for a typical, let's call it a 3DK 120 square meter house.
Well, I mean, in our case, again, it can be kind of difficult to say exactly what's going to be needed just because it varies. But generally, I mean,
not to renovate. I mean, once it's livable and it's like ongoing with somebody living there and it's already in livable status, not like a complete renovation.
Oh, in that case,
maintenance.
Then, yeah, not much at all. There are outliers. I think I mentioned recently that there was a place we were working with that just the garden itself cost real good jumayen per year to take care of. So that's kind of a lot depending on your circumstances. But generally, like once you get the thing up and running, I mean, I don't even know if it, honestly, does it even change across kind of geography? And I mean,
the roof, walls, tiles, there's got to be something that needs a bit of maintenance, no?
Well, you know, I mean, what?
Go ahead.
I'm gonna just sort of jump into that and say, we don't really do a monthly, how can I say, like, save. I don't put money aside monthly for those potential maintenance costs, right? Like every 10, the big ones you need to do when you have a house, every 10 years, they say 10 to 15 years, but I think 10 years would be a bit better, is the exterior maintenance.
If it's a new house, if it's a relatively new house.
Yeah. Like, let's say a brand new house, right?
Yeah.
After, actually, Tracy, I see two videos you've got up.
Oh, really? Oh, so, yeah.
Oh, no, that's it.
We got two Tracys. Oh, my God.
Oh, there you go. She's close enough. All right. You're muted, though. Okay, so anyway, I'll continue while she gets her stuff sorted.
Carry on.
So the exterior maintenance of the building is probably the big cost that you need, like when you have a house, like a three-bedroom house. And that requires sort of painting of the exterior walls and painting of the roof. And that's done about every 10, and like if you have a balcony, the repainting of the water, of the it's like a fiberglass floor for the balcony area. For waterproofing.
And the roof needs to be re-waterproofed, right?
Not really waterproof, just like maintain, like, so if it's after 10 years, if everything's still in good condition, yeah, they repaint it. Houses now in, you know, they have, it's not actually waterproofing, the tile type sheets that they have on the roof are there for fire. That's so fire from neighboring houses, more fireproofing, does not come onto, like, so they don't burn. Underneath it is like a plastic sheet that is for the waterproofing. Okay.
Yep.
So what happens is if every 10 years or so, they'll clean you see they put the scaffolding up around the building and they basically clean the whole building and then repaint, and any cracks or anything like that, they'll sort of putty it up. Or if it's a cement rendering,
yeah,
that they have the mortar. If it's that kind of rendering that they have on the building, then yeah, they fix up any kind of cracks that may have happened. And remember, even under the render is plastic sheeting for waterproofing. So even if there's cracks, it doesn't mean water's going in and destroying the property.
Yeah. Okay?
So yeah, they patch all those up and then they repaint the house and repaint the roof. Okay. So it's all sort of clean and re-protected by the paint. And you want to do that maybe every 10 years. Because like we've seen some houses, they're like, you know, say 18 years old or so, and they've never been maintained, or, you know, it's gone to 15 years and they've never been maintained. And that's when you go, obviously, oh, you go inside the third floor, in the closet, there's a water leak from the ceiling,
yeah,
right? Or there's another, and the exterior starts to get, you know, a bit tatty, or the roof starts to fall apart that it needs replacing.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you don't maintain it in a timely fashion, then I think the longer term maintenance costs are more expensive. Or when you want to resell the property, it's going to lose more value than the cost of maintenance.
Well, I think we also heard the first time is maximum 15 years, and then from there on, it's every 10 years. And then what does this kind of project cost approximately in your experience?
Well, I don't, well, you know, I haven't done it yet for my own houses, but yeah. I think it's around 2 million yen.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
For three-story houses, yeah. So nothing too crazy. But, you know, I don't put aside money every month for 10 years.
No, but people want to factor that into their calculations when they buy. So that's similar to what we told them. If the house is relatively young, you should probably think about something like $2,000 a year or 200,000 yen a year. Yeah. As it gets older, maybe notch that up to 300,000 a year, past the 20-year mark or so, and so forth.
Yeah.
And how about interior, Tracy? You'd have a lot of experience with that.
I just give my opinion on buying. When you build a house with one of the building companies, a lot of these maintenance things are actually built in, and they have a lot of warranties as well. So, you know, my house.
For how long?
Well, the exterior of my house is actually, all the waterproofing for my house is guaranteed for 30 years, which is about the life expectancy of the house itself.
Well, from a tax perspective, for sure, yeah. It's even less than that, I think, yeah.
And then they have regular, you know, maintenance scheduling built into, so, you know, we have people come in every 6 months and check out the house, and that's part of what you pay for. You know, if you go with a contractor and an architect, that's you're probably up for that yourself. But the peace of mind that we got by, you know, not necessarily being native Japanese speakers, having a building company was that peace of mind of having that maintenance built into it. Because of course, if a house that's been built by a building company falls down in 5 years, of course that makes them look bad. So it's in their best interest to you know, have that built into the cost. I mean,
Now we're going to interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say that. We're going to interrupt this broadcast to give you a quick reminder that NTI is now partnered with Mita Securities Hospitality Property Fund, and they're offering their mind-blowingly gorgeous Machiya townhouses in Kyoto. So there's four of them, each about 100 years or older, lovingly restored and renovated to modern standards luxury. Stunning architecture and comfort, all the modern conveniences, including your scenic indoor or outdoor bath, spectacular dining and sitting rooms, disgustingly decadent Japanese or Western style bedrooms, high-speed Wi-Fi internet, kitchen, outdoor decks, Japanese gardens, the works. Now, each of these homes can comfortably host two or three families, including kids. So anywhere from one or two guests and all the way up to a dozen or so. And you can rent the entire house to yourself. So no other guests. It's all yours. Run around naked all day and night long, if that's your thing. Supreme Japanese style luxury accommodation. And since at the moment there are still no foreign tourists in Kyoto, these places are available for rent at ridiculously low prices. So we're talking as little as $430 for a whole week. That's right, luxury accommodation for an entire clan, two families or more, for as little as $400, $500, or $600 a week. Obviously, the longer the stay, the cheaper the rate is, but you can rent these for anywhere between one or two nights and up to a month or more. So perfect for a weekend getaway, extended holiday, workcation, family reunion, company retreat, or even as a gift to a valued client. Whatever you might have in mind. And if you book these through our website, you're also going to get an added bonus of one or more 3,000 yen. So that's $30 QUO cards, QUO. Those are gift cards that you can use all around the country in convenience stores, restaurants, various stores, lifestyle shops, you name it. The number of cards you'll get depends on the length of the stay, but you'll always get at least one of these. So if you're in Japan, or even if you're out of Japan, but you think that you might be able to get in sometimes in the next year or two, and you've been thinking about spending some time in Kyoto, this is your chance to nab the best accommodation deal possible. So we'll link to the bookings page, which also has some amazing photo galleries for each of these properties on offer. Now, they all come with a fully equipped kitchen, but you can also choose to have your meals delivered to the property if that's your thing. The operator can arrange that for you at very reasonable prices. And if you can't see the show notes for any reason, just go to our website, nippontradings.com. That's N-I-P-P-O-N tradings with an S, all one word, nippontradings.com/Kyoto-holiday-rentals. Or just go to nippontradings.com and you'll see the Kyoto Holiday Rentals option on the top right menu bar. Now, we are already taking bookings, so some of the properties may not be available on your dates, but me, the security guys are super accommodating and they'll do their best to find you an available property for whenever it is you're planning your trip. Get on there, book your inquiry, and take that dream holiday in Kyoto that you've been fantasizing about while these phenomenal prices are still available. And now back to the podcast.
I mean, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. I mean, I paid for it when I built the house, so I'm not naive like that. But use those. You know, when you use a building company, work that relationship. You know, get as much value out of that as possible, because you are paying for it. So we make sure every time someone comes around that we have a list of things that we've got questions about. And we get them to fix it, and we get them to fix it for free.
We usually buy secondhand, so I actually was not aware of that.
That's an interesting question. If you buy secondhand, find out the original building company. I mean, if it's changed from the original owner, the warranty is attached to the building itself. Hang on a second, I've got construction next door.
Yeah, well, Matt's milking his goats, and Tracy's got construction. That's right, she's back.
No, I'm back. It's just that there's construction going on next door, and they're noisy as anything, and drives me nuts when I'm, you know, trying to do Zoom and I'm trying to do webinars and stuff. So, but that's an interesting question, though, Ziv, and that's maybe some homework that could be for you or for Emil. Is that, you know, if you're buying a secondhand property that has been built by one of these large building corporations, does the warranty stick with the house, or is it with the original contract signer? So that's an interesting
question. Is it just the large building companies, or does any developer is any developer obliged to do that?
I don't know. I know the larger, can't speak from my own experience. Yeah,
I know the larger, like when it's a Chumon Jutaku, you know, like Mitsui Ringyo, that, you know, do, or is it Sumitomo Ringyo? Anyway, yeah, like those homes, those big developers, they'll say, yeah, you know, we'll give you a 30-year warranty on the house for like structural and waterproofing, where standard is 10 years. So any developer will give 10 years a standard, that by legal obligation. Some will do 20 or 30 years. However,
that's for owner occupiers, or is that for, like, say, a developer who built a small apart, or like, say, 6 or 8 units? Do they also offer this kind of thing?
Well, I haven't done that, but generally for personal homes, the standard homes, I don't know what policy they have, is if you're tenanting it or not. But if it's, yeah, generally for personal homes, they will give you, if you want, like that 30-year warranty, but you have to do the maintenance, as Tracy was saying, on their regular schedule.
Yep.
So I think she said that they come around every 6 months to do some, like the tank chem, the basic inspection.
Yeah.
But if there's something, like maybe after 10 years or so, when they'll say, look, now you have to do the big the painting and the daikyo shuzen, like the large scale every 10 year maintenance, that's probably out of pocket. I don't think that will be
included. I would assume that out of pocket.
And it might be a little bit more expensive than what you can get on the open market for that same maintenance. But in order to keep that warranty, you need to use their maintenance. So some people comment that, oh, you know, like it comes with a 30-year warranty, but you have to pay their maintenance fees, which are a little bit more expensive than what you can get elsewhere. But that, again, that's something that it depends on how your perspective on it. It could be beneficial, or it could be, you know, something you don't want to deal with. You think you can get it cheaper, but at the end of the day, every 10 years or so, you're going to need to do that large scale building maintenance, and you can budget, say, 2 million yen it shouldn't be 3 million, depends on the scope of it. But if the house is in relatively good condition already, then that's what you can look at. And the other important one, you know, you mentioned interior, is usually the wet areas. So bathroom, toilet, kitchen, they have a lifespan of say 15 years to 20 years. After about that is like, ooh, it's getting a bit tired and a bit old, time to change.
Yep.
Just time to change it. And that will cost, you know, for a house, say, if you want to do it cheaply, 5 million yen, I think will get you, like, you know, a new bathroom, toilet, kitchen, maybe 7 million.
5 million,
and wallpaper as well.
Maybe because we deal with usually smaller mansion units, we've never had to pay more than 1.5-2 million yen tops for a new bathroom.
But that's, yeah, that's for just a new bathroom, right?
Well, the whole new unit bath, the whole room.
Yeah, yeah. I said, yeah, but bathroom, toilet, kitchen.
Oh, kitchen and too. Okay.
Yeah. So your new kitchen is going to be like 2 million yen.
Yeah.
Okay. Bathroom, yeah, 1 million. And also remember, it's your personal home, not a rental. When it's rental, it's like a very base grade, heavy duty, bland, plain thing that, you know, you're quite basic. Whereas when it's your own personal one, it's like, oh, I want the electric faucets. I know. You know, the nicer quality cabinets with the auto close, the shinier finish, you know, the nice built-in water filter.
If you want guests to come in and short-term stay at like Tracy does, then you need an even nicer renovation inside, right?
When you do a short-term rental that you splurge on, some that you can save on. You know, it's a different, short-term rentals around the world are a different animal. So, you know, things like your utilities, you need to budget a lot more because utilities are very expensive. And then when you're buying furniture, etc., then you need to, you know, you can get secondhand furniture, but you need to get new. The things that people touch need to be new and shiny. So towels and sheets, and they're consumables, and you need to get those on a regular basis. But in terms of actual maintenance of the bathrooms and kitchens, we use it as a feature, not a bug. So so we've got some classic Japanese houses, which I wouldn't want to live in full time, but they've got their own kind of charm. And
what, as like long the as deep metal baths and stuff like metal, that. Yeah,
the deep metal baths, the bathrooms that have tiles with like mosaics in them, things like the things that I can't deal with are the gas heaters that hang off the wall, like the hot water heaters that hang off the wall. I can't deal with that. Or the gas heaters where the bath heater is a separate little unit. Because people just don't know how to use them. They're a kind of a quirk of Japan. And you know, whenever I'm taking over a short-term rental, I'll insist on a proper gas, like upgrade the gas water heater, which costs about like nijuma yen to do, like 200,000 yen to do it. But those old style gas bath heaters,
so that's up to $2,000 or just a bit under that.
Yeah. Well, they've been known to cook. Like if you fall asleep in one of those, you can cook. Yeah. And people have died in those things. And so in terms of like your liability for a short-term rental, there are some things that are, I find are non-negotiable, and that's one of them. But then there are other things like, you know, the cabinets might be a little bit old or whatever. I can live with them because I can pass them off as the charm and as a classic Japanese experience, rather than a brand new system kitchen. So, I mean, it really does come down to your marketing on how you sell it.
It depends on the property and the guests too, right? Like you wouldn't sell a funky central Tokyo apartment as having old school charm, right?
That's right. It really depends on who you're targeting, like who you're selling it to, and making sure that their expectations are fully transparent. Like, you know, you can't sort of sell a luxury, you know, top of the range, everything that opens and shuts, and have some janky kitchen in there. It's like that just won't fly. But you can make a very good living without spending a whole bunch of money upgrading something that you can pass off as a charm, a charm point. I'm sorry, I've been in Japan for too long, right? It's like a charm point.
I've seen that.
I see that a lot in the kind of the more rural area. Well, the opposite of that, actually, which is, to be quite honest, like a very large point of frustration for me, is a lot of people, usually not the new ones who we've been dealing with, but ones who are kind of established in, you know, for example, around Atami, this happens. They might think it's charming, but yeah. I look at what they're offering and I'm just like, well, number one, you know, the photos on your listing are from 10 years ago and the kitchen doesn't look like that anymore. And, you know, this, that, and the other, and the excuse across the board, I'm actually curious, Tracy, to hear your reaction to this is, I mean, 100% of the time it's, well, you know, it works well enough. Right. Yeah. And I'm just like, geez Louise, you haven't even thought about, you know, profit loss or, you know, what this would even cost or just all these other things. And it's not everywhere, but where it occurs, I find that it's extremely kind of strong, almost like a belief of like, no, this is the way that it must be done. And for a little bit, I was kind of like, oh yeah, but you know, what if I say it like this and then we can make your business? And it's like, nobody wants to do it.
This is unfortunately not uncommon for sellers worldwide. I was actually surprised when it happened in Japan. Like we deal a lot with tenanted properties and there's always a clause in the purchase contract that says that if the tenant leaves or notifies that they're leaving between the signing of the contract and the settlement itself, so there's usually like 3-4 weeks period between, then the seller is responsible to renovate the property back to rentable condition. And the gap between what the buyer thinks is rentable condition and what the seller believes is rentable condition is very, very wide. Like, we don't need to change the wallpaper. They look fine. No, there's got, you know, the cigarette yellow tobacco spots on it.
Yeah, there is that disconnect. And also, you know, I look at holiday rentals. So that, you know, someone who's had a holiday rental and been living and been using it as their holiday rental for 10, 15, 20 years.
They're used to it, right?
Yeah. They're used to it. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's just like, you know, it might have been top of the range in the bubble period when we built that house. You know, I'm thinking about Atami and all those places that went up in the bubble time. It's like, yeah, they might have been top of the range during the bubble time. And I'm sure that you were really proud of them now. But, you know, time's marched on, love. you need to accept that. And the only way to get around that is really to show them the alternative. If the only thing that they've seen as a seller is their own stuff, then the solution for that is education. And that's to take them to somewhere that has been renovated, that has had
What it looks like. Yeah.
This is what your place could be. And it's like, it's only because you're familiar with seeing this every day. It's like, it's really what you love is not, it's not really going to be what the market loves. So yeah.
I had a little slip up the other day with speaking with somebody who was looking to sell, not you know, to have an Airbnb or anything, and was, and I'm pretty sure that I didn't say it offensively at all, but basically like, well, no, we need to talk about general cleaning, both, you know, outside, indoors. I didn't point at anything, right, and suggest that looks terrible or whatnot, and they were just taken aback and like, how could you say such a thing?
We cleaned it before you came.
Yeah. And I mean, to their credit, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't bad by any means, but it's just a matter of like, yo, if you're preparing this thing to be put on the market, and especially
for their own benefit too, they'd be getting a lot more money if the place looks more presentable, wouldn't they? I don't know about a lot, but there'd be more chance for them.
It was a very interesting and enlightening conversation. In fact, after it, though, we ended up being buddy-buddy and just had like a great day out. So it was totally cool in that sense. But what it boiled down to, I think, was that, and this was an older person, older Japanese person as well, especially amongst that demographic, I would expect there to be, again, a very strongly held, not belief, but like supposed understanding of what real estate is and how long it takes to do something. And that's usually a number of years, basically, to get something sold. And the whole point that we're getting across is like, well, no, if you
you know, do this, 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 and there's some costs associated with that. But because of that, you know, we can jack the price up there a little bit. And we can also probably take the sale period or the time it takes to sell, you know, down. And it was these things that I ended up understanding that they did not understand. Right.
I've been hearing this story actually when we just started working in real estate in Japan. I've been hearing stories from people who say, oh, no, you know, I got in-laws in Japan and they've had this place standing vacant in Osaka and it's very central and it's been standing vacant for 5 years and no tenants and nobody wants to buy it. Well, what have you done with the place? Because we've had the opposite experience. Like, you know, places get sold within a couple of months at most if they're priced right and they look okay.
Right, right, right. And so there's, and Tracy, I think you mentioned the word education, right, is a very, yes, there's a lot of education that needs done. And it's still, I definitely don't know the right way to go about it just yet, because it is a very strongly ingrained sort of process. And it is a personal thing, too. It's not like these people are, you know, wrong for wanting to do it their way. Or something like that. I can kind of
case by case, like you did, right? You know, you show one person and then you sort of spread it, let it ripple out, kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah. An important thing to look at when discussing this particular matter, like, you know, you're trying to sell, how much should you pretty up the property to get the maximum value for it? What's the return? What's the right return?
Aging.
It's difficult. Yeah, it's difficult because, you know, the repairs that you do, like the superficial stuff, right, which are like wallpaper. Like wallpaper is an easy one. So that's about 10,000 yen per square meter of house, right? So a 80 square meter property, you know, maybe 600,000 to 800,000 yen is like the nicest sort of stuff. But
you know, again, I love your renovations, Emil. You're doing fancy renovations there.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that sounds hella expensive.
Well, you have to remember, right? Like when people are paying 80 million yen, 100 million yen.
Yeah, no,
for a property,
I agree.
And it's for their own thing, right? And I try to be a bit, I don't try to estimate the cheapest price. And yeah. What am I going to say? It's 7,500 yen per 10 square meters, per square meter, right? You know, and like 10,000 sort of an easy number. And it's generally a little bit below that. That's what I say. For an 80 square meter house, you know, maybe you can get 600,000 yen is what you can get for all the wallpapering to get really done. Because it's for your personal property, you're not going to have just that very basic sort of the cheapest.
Yeah, that's the main difference, I think.
Right. And also relative to the price of the property, right? Yeah, it's $1 million house. You don't want to say you're really going to get the cheapest versus the most expensive wallpaper is 200,000 yen.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're going to spend 500,000 yen or 700,000. Well, you know, I'd rather get, yeah. And it's such an important figure. It's the most visual thing that you see for the most part inside your house, and you're going to live with it for several years.
We should probably mention to viewers who are not residing in Japan that painted walls are very much not the thing here. Almost everywhere is wallpaper. And when we say wallpaper, we're not talking about like Grandma Rachel's, like 50 years ago, like flowers and ferns. We're talking about smooth wallpaper that, or slightly accented wallpaper that actually looks like normally painted walls.
Basically your background.
Well, but the thing is, I just recently though, we're talking about wallpaper, you know, with short-term rentals, it's really hard on walls. So, you know, suitcases coming in every day, and also suitcases coming in every day, and also people
flooring too, I would imagine, right?
Oh, and flooring. So but I've been using the downtime to do a few tart-ups of the properties. I actually painted the wallpaper in one of my places.
Oh.
And it had pure white wallpaper that, you know, had a few scuff marks on it. And the cheapest option for me was paint. And I painted over it. So, you know, I'm used to renovating houses. I did it in Australia before I moved here. And yeah, it was 2 days, it was really hard to get, you know, in the stairwell of this three-bedroom house, the three-story house, But yeah, that was the cheapest option for me, was to paint the wallpaper. It looks like $1 million in small unmarked bills. It looks amazing. Really? from painting. Yeah. And it was, I think it cost me, you know, in paint, you know, less than, like, you know, a couple of $100 worth of paint, and, you know, all the little paraphernalia that you need, you know, rollers and cutting in brushes and elbow grease. So
we're all widening our eyes. Professional renovators listening in are probably like, yeah, everybody knows you can paint wallpaper. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
What?
Wallpaper? Hell, you can paint walls.
Yeah. But painting and that's the cheapest way to go. And like for me, for a short-term rental, it's then easy for me then to touch up when I've got scuff marks, or, you know, people coming in with rolly suitcases. I can really, you know, just touch up the paint then.
Plus it's all going to be the same shade, whereas with the wallpaper, once it becomes a bit jaded, you have to replace at least the entire wall, if not the entire room, otherwise everything looks uneven.
Correct.
Yeah, yes. that's really dangerous. Tracy, I definitely agree with you. For short-term type rentals, yeah, like painting over the wallpaper, because then you get a scuff, you just have to paint it. You have to repair the section of wallpaper or the entire, like the entire section of wall, and get someone in. This is just, you know, get the paint, boom, 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 and you're good. So yeah, definitely agree with that. But yeah, as I said, for my clients, people are buying their personal homes. So they come in and, you know, like, so wallpaper is the norm here, right? So the idea of painting, that's not even a discussion that we have when we're talking about renovations, or by they're buying a new property. And also I think the start of this discussion was, when someone is trying to sell their property, what kind of things can they do to maximize the price? Painting wallpaper is not one of them, right? It will be replace the wallpaper.
The buyer wouldn't see that. If they recognize that it's been painted, they'll probably wouldn't go for that, I think.
Yeah, precisely. Like this, just strip this it. Is strange. Yeah. Yeah, it's not going to increase the value. Our sellers, there's like, you know, when someone wants to sell a property, they'll say, look, what should I renovate? What should I fix up before I sell it to do it? And there's two, it's hard to balance. There's like two schools of thought. One is, you know, spend, you know, maybe ¥1 million and change, you know, all the tap handles, the door handles, give it a professional cleaning, new wallpaper, and maybe 40,000-50,000
The flooring.
Are we cleaning and polishing on the floor?
Yeah,
just to bring it back up to scratch. But if it's an old property where sometimes whoever's going to buy it is going to renovate the whole thing anyway, like the kitchen is too old, the bathroom is too old, then even if you change the taps, doesn't make a difference. You could have left the old junk stuff there, because they're going to rip it out anyway. So you're just going putting an extra expense for no reason whatsoever.
Well, in our case, because it's mostly investment properties, it's always going to be option one for us. We wouldn't, like, whoever's going to be buying this property would never want to live in it. So all they want is to be able to put a tenant in there as quickly as possible. So we always go with option one, unless it's really ancient interior.
Yeah. And the scope of prices.
Yeah.
I'll just finish up. The scope of prices is significantly different as well. Because, you know, if you're buying something in, Akia, in Naka, you're not going to spend more than the value of the whole purchase on new bathroom, new vanity. Like that will be a deal breaker if the bathroom, kitchen, toilets have to be changed, right? But
unless they're going for the land and the location.
Plus,
Tracy was saying too about like the what was it, the specialness or whatever, the quirkiness,
like the character
charm points.
Yeah, the charm point. Yeah,
there we go.
But whereas when in Tokyo people are buying 80 million yen, 100 million yen, 120 million yen, the cost of the bathroom replacement is kind of the same whether it's a 20 million yen property or 80 million yen property. But in terms of the percentage, like the buyers can just, oh, okay, it's, you know, 80 million for the property, 8 million yen for renovation. Cool, so I'm paying 88 million yen and it's going to be fully renovated.
Emil, why did you what are you doing here, guy? How are you doing that? What does that mean?
I think that's the first one.
It wasn't me the first.
I get one too? How do you do that?
Let me do Zoom. But I mean, it really does depend who you're trying to sell it to, right? So
yeah, what they're going to do with it, I think.
Yeah, if you're trying to sell it to someone who is going to live in it as their personal house, they may not have the vision of someone who is an investor. So it really does, depend on who you're trying to sell it to and at what price point. So, so there's really no hard and fast, no hard and fast rule for that.
No, but those are all very interesting points of view. I mean, exactly because they're so different and, you know, people use these places for different purposes and they do different things with them and they want them to look in different ways. So that's actually very interesting.
I am highly suspicious though of those people who enjoy the deep but square steel tub. I don't understand that one.
That's like, actually I rather enjoy that too.
Really?
Yeah, when I go over to the in-laws, yeah, it's kind of like mini onsen. I like that. Really? I like it better than the tiny sitting baths that come in those rental units or hotels.
All right, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, well,
I used to have Tracy, you'll hate this. I used to have one of those, plus it was the crank gas thing
that I hate
when I lived in Iwate. So like that thing was
I think you're a bit traumatized there. That's
yeah, I can live with the steel bath. I just can't live with the gas. You know, the gas hot water that you've got to start each time. It should be like you turn the hot water tap on, the gas starts. I mean, that's a no-brainer for, you know, modern convenience. But the actual what the tub looks like, I've seen some amazing tubs that have been, you know, Hinoki. I'd never live with a Hinoki tub. Like the mold on those things.
What's a Hinoki tub? Sorry.
The wooden tub.
I've got. Oh, they're nice at the hotel. I wouldn't want them at home though.
Yeah, oh, exactly. So it's a short-term rental experience is very different. I wouldn't want to live with it, but you can really sell any sort of tub with a short-term rental experience. What you can't sell is that hot, like, you know, really old-fashioned hot water that you need a degree in. You know,
and like a proper warning on it, saying like you might burn yourself. Please be very careful.
Yeah, Matt, no. You said you have a Hinoki tub.
Yeah, we made it. So I've got marble, like a marble. I've got two marble tubs, and then one of them we got a bunch of Hinoki and kind of like renovated it into the Hinoki tub. So like, that's what you get when you buy Akiya. Yeah.
Charm points.
Yeah. Every time I see the metal tubs, it just reminds me of like a scene where there's a bunch of cannibals just around, like there's a human inside like a little pot on a fire. I'm 6 foot. Because those metal ones, they're square, right? You can't like.
That's a lovely note.
Yeah,
we're doing a conversation on Emil. Thank you. I'll carry that image with me until the end of the day. Thank you.
I'm not going in that tub. I'm even like opening my own toilet seats. You know, it's all electric. There's a button that opens and closes by itself. I shouldn't have to, you know, touch the toilet. You know. You know, you got the cleaner spray, the dryer, it's all automated. I know, yeah.
All right.
That's me.
I think with that, we've been at it for a while, so we can probably call it a day with tubs and baths. But yeah, quick round of, we haven't done introductions today, actually, so maybe outros.
Outros.
We'll start with you today, Tracy.
Okay, so it's just because I got the pink hair today, that's what it is. So, my name's Tracy. I'm CEO of Tokyo Family Stays, which is a family-friendly short-term rental business in Tokyo. The name's baked right into what we do and who we serve. And so I mainly run single-family homes in Tokyo for short stays. I also manage other people's properties for short stays in Japan. So if you have a property, you want to use it part-time and you want to rent it out part-time and make some extra money, I'm the person to be your property manager. So that's what I do. I have a Minpaku Kanri license. I have a Minpaku, each house has a Minpaku license. So I can't get you your licenses, but I can tell you what you need to do to get them. So I've been doing this for 10 years in Tokyo, and I've been in Japan for 21 years now. So, and I really love, you know, can't wait for the borders to open again, because all my customers are going to be coming back.
Hopefully, and soon.
And soon, yes.
End of the month, isn't it? Or yeah, something's sure. happening at the end of the month.
No, it's going to be emergency. Days, and I think business travelers are hopefully coming back in about 2 months, or that's what they're talking about, but not tourists, not yet.
I think next, well, re-entries have now started up. So for places that had poor numbers, that the re-entries have been like from India and other places like that. That's if you've already been in, like a re-entry is that you've already been here before and you're coming back again. New visas, so new business visas, and then like I think new business visas will be first, and then short-term visas, so tourist visas, they will be probably mid-December. That's my prediction. You heard
tourist
it here first.
Visas mid-December? Oh, fingers crossed.
That's my hope. I think you know, by November we'll be having business travelers back, people that have had their certificate of eligibility approved and they're just waiting on their entry, their first time entry. I'm fully expecting. There was an announcement in the Japan Times that Kyoto is going bankrupt because they went from 39 million visitors down to 450.
And yet all of the residents are really, really hoping the tourists will never come back.
Right. So yeah, you might want to
not the business owners, but the residents. Jisan Basan want the tourists to stay out.
No, well, that's tough. I'm sorry, that's tough luck. You know, it's like
let's move on. This is the pit we always end up.
Emil doesn't like this to go off topic.
Yeah.
All right, Emil.
It's never ending.
Give us the
this is the Japan real estate experts panel, not the foreign tourism expert. Or it's not foreign tourism speculative panel. My name is Emil. I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo. I help foreigners and mixed couples find their family home in Tokyo, and we also arrange the financing, so we can help you find a property and then also get the mortgage and finance from the mega banks. So I was hoping to do it last week, but hopefully from next week we're going to start doing Tuesday afternoons a workshop, Foreigner's Guide to Buying a House in Tokyo. We used to do it a few years ago in person, but then we sort of stopped in start of 2020 because of COVID. But we're thinking of starting it back up just via Zoom. So I'll put some information out there once it gets solidified.
That'll be very good.
Except for me.
Matt, who are you? What do you do except raise goats? Goat Tinder, is it?
It's a portmanteau, it's just Go Tinder. Go to goat. I'm Matt, I'm co-founder of Akiya and Inaka. We are a real estate consultancy partnered with a real estate agency, STK Properties, over in Ichigaya in Tokyo, that help whoever's interested really access, vet, acquire, and then also renovate and do other stuff to the various abandoned houses across the Japanese countryside for relatively cheap, not super cheap, but much cheaper than most other options out there. So if you're interested in exploring any of that, check out our YouTube channel, our Twitter, blah, 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 blah. We're across all of it. We're on Twitch is a lot of fun. You can watch us farm digitally as we answer questions about Akiya in real life at a rural residence.
Oh, I don't think I have that one in the show notes. Matt, could you send me a link to that? I'll include that as well. I've got your YouTube channel and your website.
Yeah, sure thing, we'll do. So if you want to go have a wacky time out in rural Japan, you know who to contact.
Can I just say though, Matt, what you're doing obviously is a business that is providing benefit to the people who are buying, but you know, you're really doing a service to just to rural districts. I mean, you know, you're providing a unique solution to a problem that a lot of Japanese people just throw up their hands. We don't know what to do about this. So I commend you. I think it's a really, really wonderful marriage of opportunity and opportunity for you and need. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we could talk about that for hours, but since we're doing sign off, so I'll leave it at that. But thank you.
Even if they resist, it's good for them. You drag them kicking and screaming into the 21st century. That's not a bad thing.
And Ziv, your turn.
Yeah, sure. So we do probably everything in between. So investment properties, holidays, homes, for resident or non-resident foreigners, we can help you purchase, we can help you sell anything that you're still holding to if you want to, and we can help you manage them, whether you're managing a holiday home and it needs some maintenance and TLC, or you're managing a rental property anywhere in Japan, not barring officially, but probably most of our customers wouldn't require our services in Tokyo and Osaka or Niseko, but anywhere else in Japan, investment properties, holiday homes, we're happy to help. So yeah, thanks again, guys. And we'll see you next week. And Emil, send us a link to, yes. So, oh, thank you. Thank you, Matt. Emil, send us a link to the Tokyo guide to foreigners. I think buying a home in Tokyo, I think a lot of people will be interested in that.
So sure, as soon as the date and everything is locked in, I will send you that information.
Sweet. So that'll all be in the show notes or the YouTube notes for this episode. Whoever's watching or tuning in, just go down there and you'll see it all there. Thanks a lot, guys, and see you again next week.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Yet another awesome session with the JREP crew. Thanks again for your time, folks. Pleasure as always. And again, one more quick reminder. 10 to 12 December in Hakata, Fukuoka, Business Networking and Gaming Weekend. Book your tickets now if you haven't done that yet. Really looking forward to meeting all of you face to face. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.